The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. New York Times bestselling author. She has a brand new book out, Criminal Karen Slaughter. This, quite the page turner. Karen, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome back, I should say.
Absolutely. I'm glad to be here.
All right, with Criminal, a brand new book out right now. The first page, I tell you what, from the very first page, you just want to keep going. We've got a lady who we kind of see her growing up. We really get to know her in about the first chapter. From coming from pretty much a normal family, a brother in college, she's losing weight, but then she kind of gets hooked on drugs.
Yeah, she starts taking meth, really, which is what we call speed now. But she was shooting up speed as a kid. It's something she did to lose weight. And, you know, of course, back then, diet pills were perfectly legal. People were taking speed all the time, and then they made them illegal. And so she started shooting up, and eventually she became addicted to it and ended up on the street.
So where was she getting the white crosses, I guess, in a liquid form?
Well, she got it from a nurse who was the mother of a friend of hers, and this is actually based on a true story. I know a woman who was a meth addict for 20 years, and she was shown how to shoot up by a nurse at the hospital because the woman said to her, well, you know, if you have a weight problem, this will help you lose weight.
Speed, as addictive as a lot of other things, or not necessarily so, and how addictive maybe more is the liquid form?
The liquid form is much more addictive because it's such a huge rush and it just goes into your brain and kind of explodes everything. And I know this not from personal experience, but from talking to people who have used it. One of the really dangerous things about meth now is that, like a lot of drugs, like marijuana and other things, they lace it with heroin to make it even more addictive. Drug dealers are really smart that way. They realize they need addicts out there buying drugs. And so a lot of times, you know, parents will say, oh, well, you know, my kid's smoking a little pot. I would say be careful because he's probably also smoking some heroin in there.
So how did you come about getting these addicts, if you will, or drug users to open up to you? Did they think, probably a detective or something?
Well, I don't look much like a detective. And actually, a police officer put me in touch with an addict who was an informant, a recovered addict. And he was very helpful with a lot of things. And, you know, unfortunately, it's something that's happened in my family. My sister was an addict for many years, and she talked to me about it. And we had some uncomfortable conversations. But I just hopefully have captured what some of these girls go through who are on the streets, because it's really a gateway to the streets for many women, or to jail, because a lot of times when you go into jails and you talk to women who are there, they were the ones holding the drugs and their boyfriends ran away. So it's really a problem that in many ways enslaves women, whether it's through prostitution or entering into our legal system when they wouldn't otherwise. It's just a really awful scourge.
In Criminal, I mean, we see this in the very first chapter, 1970s or so, kind of a time when maybe drugs weren't as mainstream as they are today. Is that correct?
I would think so. It wasn't really talked about in the media as much. Now you see movies, even mainstream movies, will talk about drug use. So in many ways, it's changed as far as our perception, but in some ways, we're not really telling the real stories. There are very small, fortunate few who can use drugs recreationally, and they're absolutely fine. A majority of people cannot do that. They cannot shoot up heroin and then go into work and they're fine and they never want heroin again. But really this, what this book talks about, it starts in the 1970s and then it progresses into the, present day. And you see women are still doing that. And it's really common now for men who want to pimp out women to approach them over the internet. Used to be shopping malls when I was a kid. And before that, they would just find them out at playgrounds or whatever, and to make them feel like they're interested in them and they're attractive and all this sort of thing, and talk to them and slowly groom them into becoming tricked out. And drugs play a big part of that. And you see it again and again throughout history, and certainly now. I mean, there are more women and children in slavery today than there ever has been in the history of our world.
With Criminal, you did a lot of research on this book, not only with the drugs, but also this book takes place in Atlanta. And, you know, we see things back in the 70s. We see things present time also. You do a great job of describing the city and the police force. It's a time where it was a good old boys job, I guess, at the time. And now they're doing what?
Well, they've changed quite a bit. The 1970s, really, not just in Atlanta, but around the country, is when women started to really enter the police force. They were there before, but they weren't detectives. They were mostly there to talk to women who had been raped, maybe, and then they weren't really allowed in the streets, or they were there to do meter maid duties or type reports. And in the 1970s, the federal government said, look, we're going to give these police forces these grants, but they have to comply with certain things that they do. And one of them was you have to have more minorities on your police force, and the other was you have to have more women. And so they took the money, and they couldn't get away with not putting these people out in the streets. And one interesting thing about Atlanta in the 1970s is it went from being a predominantly white city to what it is now, which is a predominantly African-American city. We got our first African-American mayor. Maynard Jackson was one of two African-American men who was voted in as a mayor of a major American city. Detroit was the other city. We like Maynard a lot better. He hung in there for a really long time. He really changed the city. He was a man who didn't see color, really. He didn't see black and white. He only saw green, which if you look at Atlanta historically, we've always been a very business-oriented city. Even before the Civil War, we had more office buildings than people. So we really are just a society that responds to that dollar. And Maynard understood that. And he also understood that the police force had to change, because as in most American cities, there was a real division between the police and the people they were supposed to protect. And they didn't really get along. And for women especially, it was difficult. They might go on to take a report and someone would spit at them or would laugh at them and say, "Where's the man?" And they had to deal with a lot of crap. And if you look at Atlanta today, we had the first African-American woman as our chief of police in Atlanta. So we really have changed a lot. In some ways, we haven't. But in a lot of ways, we've really become a city that's very integrated. And that all started in the 70s.
So what are the police officers thinking about the first woman police officer, I guess? I'm sure that you've talked to several police officers for the book, Criminal, to find out some things, whether things will work right or not.
Absolutely. I talked to a lot of men and women who were cops back then. And the men were very honest. They said, look, we hated them. We didn't want them there. We didn't think they could take care of themselves. We felt like, you know, we were working with our sisters and wives, only we could get shot at. And slowly they realized that women brought more to policing than they anticipated. One of the classic examples is a domestic violence situation. You know, a male cop would respond to that, and he would meet violence with violence, and it would quickly escalate the situation. And usually it was a very tense kind of arrest where anything bad could happen. Women can't do that. You know, there are some women, of course, who could go in and kick some butt and that sort of thing, but for the most part, they're going to talk. And that's what they did in these cases where they had a domestic violence situation. They went in, they de-escalated everything, they calmed things down. And if you look at how police are trained, that's how they're trained to do it now. Not to go in and muscle through and start punching, which is what they did before, but to just talk, treat people like they're human beings, make sure both sides are listened to, and then make the arrest, and no one gets hurt.
Karen, give me a little bit of the storyline from the 1970s and maybe a little bit of the storyline in the present day, if you would.
Well, of course, the past storyline has a lot to do with the present. One of the characters I love writing about, this is my fifth book with her, is Amanda Wagner. And she is Will Trent's boss. They both work at the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. And Will sort of loves her and hates her. And I kind of love her and hate her, too. I think every person I know knows an Amanda Wagner. She's in her 60s now. She's a deputy director of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. She has a lot of power. But she did what a lot of women of that generation have done and continue to do. She got to the top, and she pulled the ladder up after her. And I really wanted to talk about why she got that way, what made her particularly hard on other women who work for her. And having talked to women who were police officers in the 70s and seeing what they had to put up with, I mean, some of them were afraid they were going to be raped by their bosses, or, like I said, they were spat on in the street and jeered at, and, you know, they were in situations where they were really, more than the men, putting their lives and their livelihood at danger. And then they got home and their moms would say, well, why are you doing a man's job? Or they would get calls in at the police station where a person who was out doing chores or something during the day would say, I just saw a woman steal a police car, because it never occurred to them a woman would be a cop. So they were dealing with all this push and shove, not just on the job, not just from their fellow cops, but from their families. And Amanda had to deal with that. And I suddenly realized why she's so angry and why she's so hard on Will's partner, Faith Mitchell. Because Faith relatively has it easy, you know. She doesn't have to fight these constant battles every day. She still puts up with crap, but she can tell them to shut up, and then that's it, and they move on.
Well, Amanda's father was on the force also. It seemed like the cops were a little more lenient on her, would you say?
I would say that they were more lenient, but there was a reason, and that's because they were afraid of her father. They were afraid she would tattle on them, and so they weren't, you know, I found this today also, where some cops, and I mean men and women, will look at people in a very black and white way, and they're the good people and they're the bad people. And because Amanda was the daughter of a police captain, she was considered one of the good women. And she typed the reports for people, and she never talked back. And even though she had an opinion, she kept it to herself. You know, this is a Tom Jones song. She's a lady, you know. And so what we see in Criminal is her slowly getting really angry about that, very angry that no one will listen to her, that they constantly talk over her, that she's feeling very marginalized. And she knows she's good at her job. She knows this case she's working on in the 1970s is an important case. It's bigger than people think it is. And, of course, it has repercussions in the present day as well. But in the present day, we see a very different Amanda, because she's in charge of everything, and she gets to choose how this is investigated.
And she runs things by the book, I would think, too, doesn't she?
She does, and she's really good at knowing the book. You know, she knows how to skate very finely on those laws and what she can and can't do. But she also has what I call her good old girl network. We all know the good old boys. But all these women she came up with when she was a young police officer are now in really big positions of power. One of them is running the airport precinct, which oversees the busiest passenger airport in the world, which is Hartsfield-Jackson Airport. You know, one of them is working with the IRS. One of them is working with the Postal Security, for instance. And these women have a lot of power within those realms, and they can all help each other when something happens. And we see her calling on this good old girl network, which is kind of similar to the good old boy network that her father was part of for a really long time. You know, in the 1970s, we were about 15 years removed from when the Klan was taken out of the police force. And so you still have some of that holdover. Then you have the African Americans who, prior to the early 1960s, weren't even allowed to be at the station. They had to stay at the YMCA and wait for calls. They really weren't allowed to wear their uniforms unless they were on duty, so they had to change into their uniforms. And they were only allowed to arrest black people until, I think, 1962. So you're dealing with these men who for so long were under the foot of these white men, and now suddenly the black men have the power. And really, that's so fascinating to me to see how the discrimination worked both ways, and the only thing they could agree on, black or white, was that women did not belong in the police force. And so the women had to kind of bind together in some ways to fight not just the system, but to do their jobs. Because at the end of the day, that's one thing I know about all police officers I've ever talked to. They're not doing the job for the money or the glory. They're doing it because they love what they're doing, and they really want to help people.
Karen, you have a book, I'm sure, that just came out in soft cover not long ago. What was your last book?
Fallen. And that really focuses a little bit more on Faith Mitchell and Will Trent, the character I've been writing about in these last five books. And I love that story. It sort of sets up Criminal in a little bit of a way, because we see Amanda's good old girl network, and we meet some of the people in Fallen that eventually we see as young women in Criminal. And that was a lot of fun for me. You know, I knew Criminal was going to be my next book, and I kind of had the luxury of setting that up. And, you know, I love books that talk about strong friendships, whether it's between men and men, men and women, you know, women and women. I think that's really the point of reading books, is to feel like you're connected in somehow to people, in some way to people. And with Fallen, it opens up very, very tense. Faith Mitchell comes home from work. She knows her mother is there with her child, and she starts to go into the house, and she realizes something's not right. She feels it, and she looks down, and she sees a blood trail across the carport, and then she sees a bloody handprint on the door, and she knows her mother's in there. She doesn't know where her baby is, and she basically grabs her shotgun and goes in and figures out what's been going on. And I love those sorts of books that open up with, you know, somebody with a gun going in and taking charge. It was a lot of fun to write.
So what's the secret of doing a book like this? I mean, you know, right off the bat, you see that trail of blood, the handprint. I mean, you bring this story to life because I can actually see the handprint. The color of blood, of course, is red. But how do you go about making something like Criminal so visual?
Well, I do see it in my head as well, because these characters are so real to me. And Will Trent is one of my favorite characters to write. I feel like I know almost everything about him. We get some of his story in Criminal about who he is, why he is the way he is. The one thing I really love about him most is he's a man who really understands women. He was raised in care, so he was raised by women. He works for women. He's in love with a woman, you know, so he's surrounded by these women, and he knows how to navigate that, and he knows how to maintain his masculinity despite being surrounded by all these very strong-headed women. And I love the little things he says as asides, and just how he's managed to operate for so long. And really, I think that excitement about characters is what makes a book good. You can always tell when an author just loves what they're doing and loves writing about the character, and hopefully people see that with my books.
How have your characters aged through the years of writing the books, or is this like one day here and the next book is another day?
I think since I started writing about Will, he's aged maybe 2 years. Would that we all could do that. I keep saying that I'll never do to Sarah what's happened to me, which is I turned 40. But maybe when I'm 50, I'll let her turn 40, because I'll think, well, 40 wasn't so bad, was it? It does give you a little perspective as you get older. What I do try to do is make sure that they respond to what happens in the books, because I am writing about crimes, and I'm always conscious that these aren't made up, really, because I can't come up with a crime that's more horrific than something that's already been done. There are really awful people out there, and I don't want to exploit that. I want to always be conscious when I'm writing about someone like Lucy Bennett, who we talked about, who is at the opening of Criminal. This is someone whose life was this. This is how she started out as a young girl and grew up and became a target of a criminal. And I want to make sure I honor that. And I don't want my characters to not be affected by the job they do. And you see that, hopefully, even from my Grant County series, which I wrote for many years, and 6 books in that series. You see that what happens from one book to the next has sort of a cumulative effect on people, and they don't make a wry comment and just move on. And it's not to say I didn't write the book so that you could read them out of order and understand what's going on, but I want readers to know that I take these things seriously. And it, for me, it's really about the character. How does a person like Will Trent go home to his girlfriend after a day where he talks to a cold-blooded murderer?
Most of your books are one-word titles, with the exception of maybe, what, one?
Faint Cold Fear and Beyond Reach.
So is that something that you strive for? You try to get just one word that says it all?
I do. And for this book, Criminal, I mean, it plays out in many ways. I mean, it's criminal what women have to put up with. There's a criminal at the center of it. It's criminal what the crime is, you know, that someone could target someone like a Lucy Bennett who's marginalized in society. I mean, all of it plays into that. And Fallen was the same way, you know. There are two people who fall in love. There's a cop who has fallen, that sort of things. And it really is important to me to get that title. I really struggled starting my next book, which will be out next year. It's called Unseen. And I couldn't start it until I had the title. And, of course, I lots of my titles come from the Bible. And it was Faith is the Absence of Things Hoped For, the Evidence of Things Unseen. And I thought, well, that really works for what I'm doing.
I was telling somebody about the book the other day, and it's like, well, Karen Slaughter, what does she write? And I said, I said she writes thrillers. It's called Criminal, you know. Figure it out. Which the title says it all right there, I think.
I think so, and I love the title, especially because it looks good on T-shirts. You know, I love people walking around with Criminal across their chest. But it just seemed like, you know, a great title for the story, especially considering what Amanda has to go through. And if you think about where she started out and where she is now, it's really fantastic that she was able to do this. I mean, that's, to me, one of the American dream sorts of things. If you want someone who's pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, look at a woman who started being a police officer in the 1970s. They're probably running the force now.
So you read the Bible a lot, I guess?
I studied the Bible in college, and of course I was raised Southern Baptist, so I didn't have any choice. So we drink it from our mother's milk in the South. I have great respect for religion and for the Bible. I think is a book. It's got a lot of great things in it. Unfortunately, some people read it and see nasty things, which is, I guess, the nature of human beings. You can find a justification just about anywhere for what you want to do. And, you know, I think being a Southern author, I can't write about the South without, in some way, writing about religion. And my characters aren't particularly religious. Sarah is agnostic, actually. Her mother is very religious, and she's religious in that way that I really love and remember from my childhood, which is she wants to do good works. She wants to take care of people. She has this sense of Christian duty. And that's very much what my grandparents were all about and what my father was all about, you know, is that you reach out to help people.
All right. Well, you have a brand new title for your new book. I was kind of surprised to hear you say that you would not start a book without a title, I guess. You've done that on every book?
I have, absolutely. And, you know, I will say that when I finish one book, I write the opening chapter for the next one because I want the tone to be consistent and I want to remember where I am emotionally with the characters. But as far as the actual story, I couldn't really get the story until I had that title. And I started thinking about a lot of different things. But, you know, people always say, where do you get your ideas? And authors are, you know, just stunned because we have no idea where we get our ideas. But I actually know that the little seed for this next book was planted because I was watching something on the IRS. I'm a real geek. I was watching the Discovery Channel behind the IRS, and I saw that they have undercover agents for the IRS, which is a terrifying thought to all of us, I think. Mostly they go in to infiltrate the mob and gangs and things like that and get them for tax fraud, which I think we can all agree that's a good thing. But they train in Georgia, in Brunswick, Georgia. And I thought, oh, I like the idea of that. Maybe I can have Will go undercover and do something. And so he's unseen.
So did you have a chance to go talk to anybody in that group?
I haven't talked to the IRS people yet. The Georgia Bureau of Investigation has been wonderful with their time and let me talk to their agents. And it's been such a pleasure to get to know some of these people because they're just doing a fantastic job. I'm not an author who writes books where the cops are the bad guys. I just think we're really lucky we have people who are willing to do this for so little money, sort of like we are with teachers and librarians. If you were their friends, you would say, why are you doing this? But as a citizen, I'm feeling really lucky we have them. But they've told me lots of things. I've talked to people who have been undercover and who have investigated crimes, and I just feel really lucky that they'll talk to me.
Karen, let's find out about a website where we can maybe go find out a little more about criminal. Maybe you have the first chapter up. Maybe you have people talking about it on your website. I need to go there.
Well, and actually at KarenSlaughter.com, that's Karen with an I, we have a really cool interactive site about criminal, and it shows lots of pictures of Atlanta in the 1970s and now. I put together some movies with songs I paid lots of money to get legal clearances on, so I hope people will watch that and appreciate that I paid for music. And I have ads and old things like that from the 1970s that are just hilarious, like Fredericks of Hollywood. I mean, I'd completely forgotten about them, and I have articles from Cosmo and that kind of thing. So it really is fun to click around on that.
How has Atlanta changed through the years?
It's changed dramatically. Just looking at the cityscape, we have so many more buildings. But what was really startling was I was able to find some of the places, the old places that I write about, like the Atlanta Union Mission. You know, the building is still there, and I have an old picture of it in the 70s and a present-day picture. I drove around with a friend of mine to get the present-day photos, and it really is miraculous how much things have changed, but in many ways have stayed the same. One thing is the Varsity Restaurant, which is a huge drive-in. They serve about 30,000 people a day. All the presidents who come to Atlanta go there. Bill Clinton, we couldn't keep him away. He always wanted a chili dog. But it's really an Atlanta institution. And if you look at pictures of it in the 70s and now, it looks almost exactly the same.
Well, the brand new book is Criminal. It's out right now by Karen Slaughter, New York Times best-selling author. Amanda's back. Will's back. It's a fantastic story. All right, hey, for a page-turner, check out Criminal by Karen Slaughter. Might as well just get the rest of the books in the series also. You've been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Karen Slaughter, author of her brand-new book, Criminal. To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.